because Captain Araki saw that the American column was heading left to right in front of him, so that if he turned left, he would escape their fire and attention more easily. Unlike Captain Araki, Sawa decided it was more important to save his own skin than that of his admiral. So, less gallantly but more sensibly, in the words of Guadalcanal historian Richard Frank, Sawa swung the Kinugasa hard to port. It saved his ship, for now. But around this time, it occurred to Admiral Scott that he should probably report that he was in combat with the Japanese. At 11:54, he sent a three-word message to Admiral Gormley and General Vandegrift, engaging heavy cruisers, a very informative message that C.W. Kilpatrick described as designed to keep both recipients awake the rest of the night. At midnight, Scott sent a very different voice message to his force. All ships cease firing. Evidently, he feared that his formation was coming apart, as so often happens in night engagements, and he wanted to straighten it up. To that end, 1 minute later, the admiral ordered, "Flash recognition lights and form column. Destroyer Squadron 12, acknowledge." This last message apparently generated no response, for Scott had repeated four more times, calling various ships out by name to acknowledge receipt. Those that did so with the word Roger. The significance of this word would be re-examined after this night. Two did not, the Boise, which never even obeyed the first order to stop firing, and the Duncan, whose radio suite had been destroyed. In the absence of the leading destroyers, Admiral Scott's flagship, San Francisco, was now leading the American column, which had by now crossed the Japanese front and was steaming away from it. By this time, the Japanese ships had turned around and were heading west-northwest toward Shortland, trying to build up speed. Without formal orders, Scott turned the San Francisco to course 290 degrees true west-northwest to lead the cruiser column in continuing the fight with a retreating bombardment force on a roughly parallel course. As he did so, the burning Fahrenholt, now listing 9 degrees, cut in front of the flagship heading south-southwest and continued away from the battle. Four fires were visible to the Americans. One was the Fahrenholt, three were unidentified. Of those, one was the Duncan, all by herself. One was the Aoba, who some mistook for being sunk, since she had completely covered herself with a smoke screen so soon after being hit hard, and one, the biggest, was the Furutaka, now crawling along at 5 knots. For the Japanese, it was now every ship for herself. They were all fleeing, thinking only of escape. Except for one, Kinugasa. Alone among the Japanese skippers, Captain Sawa had recovered from the shock of the American attack. Some 4 miles north of the San Francisco, the Kinugasa was screened from the pursuing squadron by the burning Aoba and Furutaka, and the aggressive Sawa was determined to strike back. And, unlike the other Japanese skippers this night, Sawa had remembered the Japanese credo, when in doubt, launch torpedoes. The Salt Lake City had developed a horribly inaccurate firing solution on the Kinugasa and spewed 8 10-gun salvos which she thought straddled but actually all missed. Speeding for Shortland at 30 knots, Captain Sawa struck back with a salvo that landed just astern of the San Francisco, who had resumed firing at the Aoba. By a hard right rudder at 12:06, the Boise had narrowly dodged 2 long-lance torpedoes the Kinugasa had spit out. SG radar found a contact off the starboard beam. Captain Moran ordered the searchlight snapped open, trying to pin the contact. All it did was serve as a nice point of aim for the Kinugasa. With her forward turrets masked by her superstructure, the old Japanese cruiser let loose with her aft turret. With only one dual turret at long range with no radar, the Kinugasa was shooting beautifully with twin 8-inch mounts, according to the Boise's Captain Moran. She straddled us repeatedly along the forward half of the forecastle and made 2 known hits. More hits than that, according to the Boise's damage report. One shell, possibly from the secondary battery, hit just below the left gun of turret 1. At the same time, 1 8-inch salvo sent 1 Type 91 armor-piercing shell into the barbette of turret 2, and another plunging into the water to pierce the Boise's hull below the waterline and bounce into the magazine for turret 2, where it exploded. They had started a fire that quickly spread to the magazines for turret 1 and forced the abandonment of all 3 forward turrets and started flooding. Yet another 8-inch hit, also below the waterline, worsened the flooding. It was indeed a beautiful job of shooting by Captain Sawa's crew, who had managed to get the Type 91 shell, designed to dive into the water and hit the target below the waterline, to do exactly that. With her forward turrets ablaze, the Boise sheered out of line to port. An explosion in a magazine is normally a bad thing. If the entire magazine detonates, the ship could be completely destroyed, as the Americans and the Japanese had seen and would see during this campaign. But the Boises did not. The crewmen in the magazine, almost all of whom were killed, had practiced safety first and sealed the powder within tanks, which did not cook off easily, and very little powder was exposed. Moreover, the flooding caused by the same hits that caused the explosion had the perverse effect of drowning the most dangerous of the fires. Even so, the light cruiser lost 107 dead and 35 wounded. Covering the Boise's exit stage port was the Salt Lake City. Captain Sawa calmly switched targets to the old cruiser, now backlit by the blazing Boise, and at 12:14 a.m. sent an 8-inch shell burrowing through the American cruiser's armor beneath the bridge at the waterline, causing minor flooding. A second hit 2 minutes later ruptured the steam line from the forward boiler room, starting a fire that forced the room's abandonment until the fire could burn itself out 5 hours later. The Salt Lake City lost some speed. Her own gunfire responses were ineffective due to her comically bad firing solutions. Admiral Scott thought discretion the better part of valor and backed off. The Kunugasa sped away from the Americans to safety. The Aoba, hit by about 46-inch and 8-inch shells, staggered away as well. The Furutaka had been hit by some 90 rounds from 5-inch to 8-inch guns and, incredibly, one American torpedo. One of the last hits at 12:05 a.m. had smashed the forward port engine room and ruptured the steam line to the aft starboard engine room, the only engine room still operational. The cruiser lost power and thus the means to escape or fight the progressive flooding. After 2 hours of futile efforts to restore power, at 2:08 a.m., Captain Araki gave the order to abandon ship. Just 20 minutes later, and 8 minutes after the evacuation was completed, the Furutaka was swallowed by the sea, stern first. The Duncan was not in much better straits. With her rudder jammed to port, she was circling at 15 knots, because the bridge, cut off from the rest of the ship by the midship's inferno that also pretty much cut off the bow from the stern, could no longer communicate with the engine room. Taylor and the bridge crew had to jump into the water from the bridge wings. The rest of the crew tried in vain to control the fire that the Office of Naval Intelligence described as uncontrollable, but with the flames reaching the forward magazines, the ship was ordered abandoned at around 2 a.m. The crew had to jump off the Duncan while it was still moving at 15 knots. Meanwhile, with combat ended, Admiral Scott tried to herd his command together for the trip to Espiritu Santo, but he had a few wayward sheep to lasso. A little before 1 a.m., Scott ordered the destroyer McCalla to find the Boise, who was last reported to be about 12 miles south-southwest of Savo Island. The McCalla headed there and searched for the damaged cruiser with no success. But she sighted a burning, unidentified ship very close to Savo and possibly aground. Several explosions aboard the blazing ship kept the McCalla at a distance, but at 2:20 a.m., the fires had died down a bit. The McCalla approached and snapped on her searchlight to reveal the ship's hull number, 485, the destroyer Duncan, abandoned and adrift. The McCalla's skipper, Lieutenant Commander William G. Cooper, decided to leave a salvage party under Lieutenant Commander Floyd B.T. Meyer with the Duncan. Meyer's team gradually brought the uncontrollable fires under control and decided the destroyer could be salvaged. After making yet another futile search for the Boise, the McCalla set out to recover the Duncan's crew, aided by aircraft and boats from Guadalcanal, starting at about 6:30 a.m. By noon, 195 of the Duncan's crew were rescued, most by the McCalla. Then the destroyer tried to tow the Duncan by the stern, the only way she could be towed, but a bulkhead collapse spelled the end, and the Duncan sank a little after noon. By then, Admiral Scott and his ships were heading southeast toward Espiritu Santo. Scott had thoughtfully requested air cover for the trip back and received it. Less thoughtfully, he had not told the McCalla that the Boise had rejoined the task force during the night. But they were in a celebratory mood. They had won the battle, based on their over-optimistic projections of Japanese losses. It was the first U.S. victory over the Japanese in a surface engagement, at night to boot, since the Battle of Balikpapan that past January, which had largely been against defenseless Japanese transports. And it was a victory, a tactical one at least. There was just one problem. The Japanese had still managed to land all their reinforcements on Guadalcanal, the Sendai Division, the artillery, the supplies, everything. Admiral Scott had not known there were two Japanese forces in the vicinity, could not tell that the San Francisco's floatplane was watching not the approaching Japanese cruisers, but the reinforcement convoy, in which the seaplane carriers Nishin and Chitose were mistaken for cruisers. Admiral Jojima had completed his job and led his ships back up the slot, but he dropped off a few. The destroyers Asagumo and Natsugumo were ordered to meet the Kinugasa, who had held up in order to cover the reinforcement group's withdrawal, and the Japanese still had to rescue survivors of the Furutaka, with whom the Hatsuyuki was already packed. The Shirayuki and Murakumo were ordered to recover the remaining survivors. It was the logical thing to do, it was the humane thing to do, and it was a bad idea. At 5:15 a.m., Lieutenant Colonel Albert D. Cooley, head of newly arrived Marine Air Group 14, personally led 6 Dauntlesses, 11 Marine, 5 Wasp Scouting 71, with an escort of 16 Marine Fighting 121 Wildcats under Major Tavis and 8 Arrow Cobras up from Guadalcanal to look for any leftovers from the action of the previous night. His strike found the Shirayuki and Murakumo north of the Russell Islands. The 11 Marine SPDs dove on the two destroyers, with only a near miss on the Murakumo to show for it. The 5 Wasp Scouting 71 SPDs, under Lieutenant Commander John Eldridge, searched a bit further before finding the Hatsuyuki near Santa Isabel. They did not get a hit either, but the day was still young. Next up at 8 a.m. were 7 Dauntlesses of the Saratoga Scouting 3 and Marine Bombing 141, led by the Saratoga's Lieutenant Commander Kern and 6 Avengers of the Saratoga's Torpedo 8 under Lieutenant Larson, escorted by Major John Dobbins and 14 Marine Wildcats from Marine Fighting 121 and 224. They followed the trail of oil left by the Murakumo after the first attack to the two destroyers now near New Georgia. The fighters strafed the two destroyers to suppress anti-aircraft fire, while the bombers maneuvered into attack position. Once again, the dive bombers got no hits, though they did get 3 near misses on the Murakumo, now packed with survivors of the Furutaka. But Swede Larson split his flight of Avengers in half to execute a perfect anvil attack on the hard-pressed Murakumo, scoring a torpedo hit on the destroyer's port side. Her engineering plant wrecked, the destroyer staggered to a halt in a cloud of steam settling in the water. Now the Japanese had to rescue survivors of the Furutaka and the Murakumo. Destroyers Asagumo and Natsugumo bailed on the Kinugasa to help their beleaguered tin can mates. They, along with the Shirakumo, were circling the Murakumo southeast of New Georgia when the Cactus Air Force next paid its respects at 3:40 p.m. Lieutenant Commander Eldridge led 11 Dauntlesses, all armed with 1,000-pound bombs, from the Saratoga's Scouting 3, the Wasp's Scouting 71, and Marine Scout Bombing 141, joined by Swede Larson's Avenger, 4 Army Aerocobras, and 5 Wildcats from the Saratoga's Fighting 5. While the fighters again strafed the destroyer's decks to suppress anti-aircraft fire, the Dauntlesses did their work. 2 near misses rocked the Natsugumo and wrenched open her hull plating, then Lieutenant Commander Eldridge planted his bomb just aft of amidships on the destroyer, causing a devastating explosion that left the Natsugumo slowly rolling over. Now the Japanese had to rescue survivors from the Furutaka, the Murakumo, and the Natsugumo. The Asagumo came over and took off the Natsugumo's crew, except for her skipper, Commander Tsukamoto Shutaro, and 15 others who were killed. The Natsugumo completed her rollover and sank at 4:27, 39 minutes after she was hit. The Murakumo, with 22 dead, was still not going anywhere. The Shirayuki took off her remaining crew, including her skipper, Lieutenant Commander Higashi Hideo, and scuttled her with a Type 93 torpedo. Having learned their lesson, for now, the remaining destroyers sped off for the Shortlands. And the scorecard for this Battle of Cape Esperance was finalized. The Americans had lost 1 destroyer and 163 men. The Japanese had lost 1 heavy cruiser, 3 destroyers, and some 565 men. Admiral Tanaka later called it a crushing defeat for the Japanese Navy. In terms of ego, it was. They took a lot of pride in their night fighting ability. They could not believe the U.S. Navy had bested them. Throughout the night battle off Tsavo Island, Providence abandoned us and our losses mounted, especially since the enemy used radar, which enabled them to fire effectively from the first round without the use of searchlights. The future looked black for our surface forces, whose fort was night warfare. It was such an embarrassment that someone had to pay. Admiral Goto's chief of staff, Captain Kijima, was sacked. Captain Araki, of the Furutaka, was defiant, tossing blame back at base air forces, faulty reconnaissance, and Eighth Fleet's inability to understand the situation, which, while a cliché, comes down to one thing. If it expected Admiral Goto's force to enter combat, why did it send the reinforcement group ahead of it? It was a stupid decision that was the basis for all the Japanese mistakes at Cape Esperance. Arrogant, overconfident, sloppy. This time it cost them. But the mission had been a success. And for that, General Vandergrift and his men would pay dearly. Sooner than anyone expected. Chapter 9 All Hell's Eve. October 13, 1942, carried the promise of a new day for the 1st Marine Division. The Amerikel Division's 164th Regiment, with some 2,200 men, was set to land. Its arrival would bring the number of American troops on Guadalcanal up to some 23,000. The Cactus Air Force had 90 operational aircraft, 39 Dauntlesses, 41 Wildcats, 4 P-400s, and 6 P-39s. Things were looking up. Where there was yet another Japanese air attack. Indeed, it was another one of those double air attacks Admiral Kusaka was trying out, leading off for 27 G-4Ms, 9 each from the Kisarazu, Misawa, and 753 air groups, led by the 753's Lieutenant Makino Shigeji, escorted by 18 Zeros, 9 each from the 3rd and 751 air groups, under Lieutenant Aoi. Following 2 hours later were 15 G-4Ms from the 751, under Lieutenant Commander Nishioka, with 18 Zeros of the Tainan Air Group, under Lieutenant Kawai. With warning from Coast Watcher Donald Kennedy and radar, the Cactus Air Force managed to scramble 42 Wildcats and 13 Aracobras. All but 4 of them, however, missed the Japanese arrival at 12.02 p.m., With no opposition, the 24 Bettys, 3 had aborted, missed Admiral Turner's transports off Lunga and lazily bombed both Henderson Field and Fighter 1. They managed to destroy one B-17, slightly damaged 12 other planes, and, ominously, set alight 5,000 gallons of aviation fuel. The Japanese thought they had destroyed some 20 aircraft on the ground and were pleased with their efforts. Only 4 Marine 121 Wildcats managed to catch the Japanese some 30 minutes after the bombing, while 2nd Lieutenant Joseph L. Narr shot up 1-0 so badly it had to fatally ditch off Rakata. In return, Narr was forced to ditch, but was recovered. The second strike was picked up on radar at 1:35 p.m. A dozen Marine Wildcats were ready to intercept, but they themselves were bounced by the Tainan Zeros. The Bettys claimed to have destroyed 30 aircraft on the ground, which overstated the actual damage by 30. 5 of the Tainan Zeros tangled with Captain Joe Foss Wildcats, shooting up Foss, who managed to get back to Henderson. So in truth, no losses for either side. Admiral Kusaka was pleased with the results, as they were inaccurately presented to him. He would keep up the two-strike tactic. Later that afternoon, 8 B-17s of the 11th Bombardment Group, led personally by Colonel Saunders, landed at Henderson, hoping to get a bed for the night after a difficult mission attacking Buka, just north of Bougainville. It was at 6:18 p.m. that things got a little strange. An artillery shell exploded inside the Marine perimeter just west of the Henderson Field runway. That was new. Where did that come from? General Vandergrift had been worried about Japanese artillery shelling the airfield, which was why he kept trying to push the Marine perimeter west of the Matanico. Unfortunately, the 1st Marine Division had no sound and flash unit to locate howitzers, so they were blind. He watched his cook, Butch Morgan, put on his old World War I helmet and head for the shelter. The general asked him, "Where are you going?" "Bombs." "No, those aren't bombs. They're either howitzers or guns." Morgan paused to think about it. Then he concluded, "Well, nothing but artillery. I'm going back to work." The shell detonations, all 150mm, continued for some 45 minutes. One landed close to the Fighting Five ready tent, where General Geiger had been talking with the Saratoga fighter skipper, Lieutenant Commander Simpler. Simpler and others went scurrying for cover, but Geiger just stood there, his fingers plugging his ears. Simpler said, "General, You know you should seek shelter as fast as possible in such a danger. The general replied, Yes, I know, but I am not going to let a goddamn Jap cause me to get my last clean uniform dirty. But Geiger would, and quickly did, move many of the Cactus Air Force fighters further southeast to Fighter One. Another 150-millimeter shell splashed about 25 yards from Admiral Turner's flagship, Macaulay, a little too close for comfort. Escorting destroyers Gwyn, Nicholas, and Starrett were dispatched to bombard the Point Cruz area west of the Matanico, from where the shells were coming, as far as anyone could tell, anyway. The shells were, in fact, courtesy of the 1st Battery, 4th Heavy Field Artillery Regiment, 150-millimeter howitzers. All in all, it was not the reception for which the 164th Infantry Regiment, now temporarily camped on the beach, had hoped. But it could have been worse. And it soon was. In the midnight air of October 13th, photographer Lieutenant Sewell of the Marine Intelligence Unit lay in his bunk, trying to sleep and failing. Sewell heard putt-putting, an underpowered aircraft overhead, not Washing Machine Charlie because it was single-engine. Must be Louis the Louse. It sounded like a popcorn machine, according to Captain Foss. Flares were being dropped for artillery. Like most of the Marines, Sewell's reserve of energy was low. Always tired, and unable to get any sleep because of that plane. Damn that plane, keeping us awake! But there was something different about these flares. They were much more colorful. Red over the western edge of the runway, white in the center over the pagoda, green over the east. Like Christmas in October. And well-spaced, like they were bracketing the Marine positions. Meanwhile, Corporal Frank Blakely, at the 1st Marines Message Center near the beach, thought he heard a sound, like from the channel, like a cork being pulled from a champagne bottle, a gentle pop. A gentle pop. The seconds passed. And then the world exploded. Outside, 1,000 rockets burst in the sky, recalled Sewell. The blast blew me from my bunk. At the pagoda, the siren started its eerie wail in the dark, announcing condition red, as shown by the black flag in the night. Some Marines, used to this routine, tried to sleep through it. General Vandegrift didn't have that option. He, Colonel Thomas, and a few staffers went into the bomb-proof trench cut out of a coral ridge. Another bombardment, nothing they hadn't been through before, they assumed. But inside the bunker, Colonel Thomas listened. He knew it almost immediately. This wasn't the normal bombardment. My God, those aren't 5 inches they're throwing at us. The talented writer, Corporal Gallant, was with one of the gun crews on the beach when, without warning of any kind, the sound of a heavy freight train filled the air, the earth shook, there was a series of great explosions, and the ground shook again. What the hell? What was that? Exclaimed one of the gunners. Where'd it come from? I didn't see any flash, said another. I didn't hear anything before, either, Gallant responded. He looked out toward the water. You see anything out there? The corporal was asked. From the beach, Gallant kept peering out into the darkness, and was stunned by a giant red-yellow explosion, like a ship had blown up, but billowing out. Look, you see that? Corporal Gallant yelled. It's a ship! They're coming from a ship! We ain't never had no ship shoot like that. Another member of the gun crew managed to force out of a throat tightened with terror. Great God! There was another giant flash, another cloud billowing toward them, in the dark out to sea. That ain't no cruiser, another crewman panted. It's one of their damn battleships, that's what it is, shouted the gunner. No doubt about it, by God, a damn battleship! The bastards are trying to kill us with a stinking battleship! The nerve. Was there no limit to the depths to which the Japanese would sink? Not even just one battleship. Two battleships, the Kongo and her sister ship, Haruna, of the Combined Fleet's 3rd Battleship Division, under the command of Rear Admiral Kurita Takeo. Admiral Yamamoto was keeping his promise to bring the battleships alongside Guadalcanal if necessary, even if it wasn't exactly the Yamato, with these two Kongo-class battleships. Converted from battle cruisers, the Kongos were lightly armored for battleships, but were fast, rated for 30 knots. Kurita had protested at the thought of sending his battleships into the restricted waters of Iron Bottom Sound. Yamamoto said the battleships were going, and either Kurita could command them, or Yamamoto would command them himself. After such an offer he obviously could not refuse, Admiral Kurita headed south with a screen formed by the ubiquitous Rear Admiral Tanaka and his 2nd Destroyer Flotilla, with the light cruiser Isuzu and destroyers Oyashio, Kuroshio, Hayashio, Umikaze, Kawakaze, Suzukaze, Takanami, Makanami, and Naganami. The battleship's magazines carried the new Type 3 shell. This shell had a casing that would burst and spread 470 individual incendiary submunitions over a wide area. It was originally designed for an anti-aircraft role, but the Japanese decided it could work well for bombardment of aircraft on the ground, fuel and ammunition dumps, and other flammable land targets. Unnoticed by Allied scout planes, Admiral Kurita's force had come down from the north to pass the south side of Savo Island at 1:31 a.m., when they slowed to 18 knots and turned a course 77 degrees true, east-northeast. With a gunnery officer from the Yamato, Lieutenant Funashi Matsutomi, whose presence attested the importance Admiral Yamamoto attached to this operation, on Mount Austin, spotting for the battleships, along with four seaplanes for illumination, the flagship Kongo opened fire at 1:33 a.m. at a range of 29,500 yards, followed at 1:35 by the Haruna. The immediate result within the American perimeter was pandemonium. About 150 men crammed into the pagoda tunnel and the underground operations room, if they could make it that far. According to Lieutenant Colonel Twining, the air seemed to turn into the consistency of jello, making it difficult to move or even remain upright. For Coast Watcher Martin Clemens, the ground shook with the most awful of convulsions, and there was dust and smoke everywhere. Our tent was in confusion as a jagged piece of red-hot steel snapped off the tent pole above our heads. The top of the tent collapsed over us, together with a few tons of earth that had been blown out of the immense shell craters. To Captain Joe Foss, it seemed as if all the props had been kicked from under the sky, and we were crushed underneath. On board the ships of Admiral Kurita's flotilla, there was excitement and celebration, according to Admiral Tanaka. The ensuing scene baffled description as the fires and explosions from the 36-centimeter shell hits on the airfield set off enemy planes, fuel dumps, and ammunition storage places. The scene was topped off by flare bombs from our observation planes flying over the field, the whole spectacle making the Roigoku fireworks display seem like mere child's play. The night's pitch dark was transformed by fire into the brightness of day. Spontaneous cries and shouts of excitement ran throughout our ships. On the American side, the psychological toll was crushing. Private Leckie. The Americans were passing through an agony not to be repeated in World War II. It was a terror of the soul. It was as though the roar of colliding planets was exploding in their ears. Self-control was shattered. Strong faces went flabby with fear. Men sobbed aloud or whimpered. Others put their pistols to their heads. It was not possible to pray. The Kongo skipper, Captain Koyanagi Tamiji, was being very careful, spacing his salvos a minute apart so Gunnery Officer Lieutenant Commander Ukita Nobue could make sure the guns were on target. They could not afford to waste the very limited supply of Type 3 shells. The Haruna, for her part, was using Type 1 armor-piercing shells, a weird choice against a land target. It seems the Japanese wanted to churn the ground to make repairs to the runways more difficult. The Marines could only respond with their 5-inch coastal defense guns, which lacked a range to reach the battleships. Admiral Tanaka's Isuzu and his destroyers shelled the Marine positions themselves to suppress the guns and shone their searchlights to blind the Marine gunners. Welcome to Guadalcanal, 164th Infantry. At 2:13 a.m., the shelling stopped. Captain Joe Foss joined other Marines, soldiers, and pilots, poked their heads out, and crawled out to see the aftermath. Fire, fire everywhere. Lieutenant Colonel Walter L.J. Baylor, the Cactus Air Force communications officer, saw a ghastly blaze of light. The Japanese saw a lake of fire. The scene was worthy of Milton, except it was not Satan and his rebellious angels chained to it, but helpless American troops. Navy Lieutenant Frederick Mears joined about 70 men in a single truck, hoping to go to the beach and get out of the main impact area. Men were yelling, even crying, and trying to hide behind one another or force their way to the bottom of the truck. Sitting on a bench in the Pagoda Hill dugout, the leadership of the 1st Marine Division relaxed a little. Colonel Thomas spoke up. "I don't know how you feel, but I think I prefer a good bombing or artillery shelling." Standing near the doorway, General Vandergriff nodded. "I think I do." His thought was cut off by a massive explosion that knocked over everyone on the bench like bowling pins. Joe Foss, the image of Marine toughness, dove back into his foxhole, landing on top of his superior, Major Leonard Davis, with such force that Foss almost killed the Major. It had only been the eye of the hurricane. The Congo and Haruna had reached the eastern terminus of their run and had ceased fire while turning around. Now heading back to the west along the coast, the battleships had resumed shelling, with the Congo now using the Type 1 armor-piercing shells and the Haruna using Type 0 high explosive. With a fire obscuring landmarks ashore, Lieutenant Commander Ukita had to use a mechanical shelling disc to ensure adequate coverage of the salvos. The Marines had never been through anything like this, not with artillery this big, not in the war, not in the long history of the Marines. At the height of the bombardment, the express train roar of the bursting salvos was so loud that it overloaded the capacity of the human ear, remembered Captain Foss. Those 2 hours were simply indescribable. Nothing like them can be imagined. Writing later, General Vandegrift agreed. Unless the reader has experienced naval or artillery shelling or aerial bombing, he cannot easily grasp a sensation compounded of frustration, helplessness, fear, and in case of close hits, shock. There had always been a surreal quality to Guadalcanal, the Marines and Army troops knew, the paradise that wasn't, but never more so than on this night. A rumbling thunder that came from no storm, the quaking that came from no shifting tectonic plate, the wail of the siren that warned of no tornado, the bright blasts of the guns of battleships barely visible in the dark. A lake of fire and a land so drenched by rain it never really dries. Some of the toughest men in the world were helpless to defend themselves, to stop this blasting, hiding in foxholes and trenches, scratching, clawing, pressing ever deeper into the ground, to dodge the fire and shrapnel flying a few feet off the ground, that 1 millimeter possibly being the difference between life and death. And in a twisted version of the Pied Piper, rats. Tens of thousands of rats poured forth from the jungle, from food stores, apoplectic at the commotion and carnage that had gripped the land and shaken it, not understanding what was happening, only that they needed to get away, they knew not how, squeaking, screaming, scratching, clawing, frantic. The surrealism extended to the victims as well. Captain Foss and Major Davis sorted themselves out to more comfortable positions. Foss started absentmindedly beating a tune on Davis' helmet. As the blasts continued, Davis exploded as well. "For God's sake, stop that. It makes me nervous." Meanwhile, an ammunition dump was exploding, and a gasoline dump was blazing fiercely near the foxhole. Second Lieutenant Danny Doyle, a newly arrived pilot for Marine Fighting 121, shared with 3 other men. Doyle leaned over to one of the others and asked, "Say, do you think it would reveal our position if I lit a cigarette?" But in the midst of this enemy naval bombardment, some Marines wondered, where on earth is the U.S. Navy? It was the hopelessness, the feeling that nobody gave a curse whether we lived or died, said Lieutenant Commander John E. Lawrence, Cactus Air Force Air Information Officer. Well, the U.S. Navy was there, just not in the form of warships or even submarines. Deployed to Tulagi on October 12th was one section of Motor Torpedo Boat Squadron 3 under Lieutenant Commander Alan Montgomery. Better known as PT boats, these were basically oversized wooden motorboats with torpedo tubes and machine guns. With the devastating power of the battleships apparent, Montgomery led his 4 PT boats out to attack anything that moved. But they promptly got separated. Since they rode low in the water, they didn't have much in the way of vision. PT-38, commanded by Lieutenant J.G. Robert L. Searles, saw a light cruiser. The only one present that night was the Isuzu, and fired 4 torpedoes, 3 of which malfunctioned. The target fired back, apparently with machine guns, as P-38 passed within 100 yards of the stern. PT-60, with Lieutenant Commander Montgomery aboard, but commanded by Lieutenant J.G. John M. Searles, Robert's brother, mistook gun flashes for hits on a destroyer. PT-60 had a few uncomfortable moments as she was chased away by the destroyer Naganami, at which point she ran aground. The PT boat attack was mostly ineffective. Admiral Kurita saw the gun flashes from the destroyers brushing off the PTs and concluded the destroyers were duking it out with a submarine. Kurita wanted none of that. Since the shelling was almost complete anyway, the admiral decided to end it 5 minutes early. The Congo's gunnery officer, Lieutenant Commander Ukita, later insisted that Kurita was more concerned about running aground than he was about the PTs. But Kurita was already known for being a bit jittery, a reputation that would only increase. In that sense, the PTs did drive the battleships away. At 2:56 a.m., after firing 973 shells, the Congo and Haruna, their towering pagoda masts resembling aloof totems in the dark, and their companions glided out of Iron Bottom Sound. They were replaced by two washing machine Charlies. Two Mitsubishi G4Ms harassed the beleaguered Americans by circling the Lunga perimeter loudly and dropping the occasional bomb, relieved by two more G4Ms who kept it up until dawn, at which point the 150mm guns took over. The guns were now dubbed Millimeter Mike, or, more popularly for those averse to the metric system, Pistol Pete. To the Americans on Guadalcanal, this night became the Bombardment, or All Hell's Eve, or, quite simply, the Night of the Battleships. When dawn finally came, the Americans came out of their dugouts, foxholes, and trenches to a shocking, demoralizing scene of abject devastation. The optimism of just 24 hours before was gone. Palm trees were leveled, palm fronds littered the ground, along with shrapnel, splinters, base plates, incendiary tubes. Tents were perforated, if they stood at all. Half the pagoda was rubble. The radio station was knocked out. Henderson Field had 13 craters, 13 holes in the Marston matting. Burning, wrecked aircraft littered the edges of the runways. Of the 39 SPD Dauntless dive bombers present the day before, only 7 were operational, which was 7 more than there were operational Avengers. 2 of the 11 bombardment groups' B-17s were destroyed, with a third damaged. At Fighter 1, General Geiger's move of the fighters now seemed prescient. The runway was far less damaged than that at Henderson. Only 6 Aero Cobras remained, but 18 of the 30 Marine Wildcats were operational. Most fortunately for the Americans on Guadalcanal, and most amazing considering the severity of the bombardment, only 41 were killed. Most unfortunately for the Americans on Guadalcanal, almost the entire supply of aviation fuel was torched. All over the base, gasoline was burning. At 5 a.m., Admiral Yamamoto issued an order stating American air power on Guadalcanal was suppressed, and thus the 2nd and 3rd fleets, Admiral Kondo's battleships and Kido Butai, were to head south and destroy the U.S. fleet, especially the carrier Hornet. So it was quite an unpleasant surprise to Lieutenant Commander Mitsui and his comrades on Mount Austin when at 5:40 a.m., 2 SPD Dauntlesses took off from Henderson Field for the Dawn Search, and 2 Marine Wildcats took off for the Dawn Patrol. These operations revealed the high-speed convoy. 6 transports, Sado, Sakito, Sasako, Azuma-san, Kyushu, and Nankai, all Marus, were carrying some 4,500 troops, the Imperial Army's 16th Regiment, 2 battalions of the 230th Infantry Regiment, and 824 men of the 4th Maizuru Special Naval Landing Force, a battery each of 100mm guns and 150mm howitzers, the 38th Field Anti-Aircraft Battalion, the 45th Field Anti-Aircraft Battalion, 1 company of the 47th Field Anti-Aircraft Battalion, the 1st Company of the 38th Engineer Regiment, the 1st Independent Tank Company, and 1 section of the 38th Division Signal Company, plus ammunition and provisions. They were escorted by Rear Admiral Takama Tamotsu's 4th Destroyer Flotilla, with the new anti-aircraft destroyer Akizuki serving as his flagship, and destroyers Yudachi, Harusame, Samidare, Marusame, Shigure, Shiratsuyu, and Ariake. And they were only 140 miles away. Inside the Lunga perimeter, sleep-deprived marine engineers and mechanics and Seabees got to work. The surviving B-17s took off using the only 2,000 feet of available runway at Henderson. The damaged pagoda, long believed to be a convenient point of aim for bombs and shells, was bulldozed. It took 3 hours to get the radio repaired enough and moved into the Pagoda Hill Tunnel for General Vandergrift to get off an urgent message to Gormley, urgently necessary that this force receive maximum support of air and surface units. He added, "Absolutely essential aviation gas be flown here continuously." The Cactus Air Force pilots called it a virtual SOS. However, U.S. Navy surface units were in no position to help. Admiral Scott's task force was resupplying and could not get to Lunga before dawn on October 15th. The lone operational U.S. carrier in the Pacific, the Hornet, was refueling. Another one of those inopportune fueling situations. And in any event, she could not take on Kido Butai by herself. Admiral Nimitz's assessment was, "Our position is not favorable to prevent a major enemy landing." But even if Admiral Garmley was not in a position or of the disposition to help, a few people were in a position to do so. Admiral Aubrey Fitch, who replaced Admiral McCain as head of land-based air forces in the South Pacific, was prepared to assist. Fitch had commanded the Lexington Carrier Task Force at Coral Sea. In fact, during that battle, Admiral Fletcher had deferred air operations to Fitch. The loss of the Lexington did not diminish Fitch's reputation much, if at all. Highly respected and a good mix of aggression and caution, Fitch recognized the danger of the situation. He did not have a lot to offer from Espiritu Santo, but what he did have he sent. 17 SPD Dauntlesses, 6 of which were from the Enterprise, and 20 Wildcats of Marine Fighting 212 under Lieutenant Colonel Bauer. 4 of the P-400 era Cobras managed to take off to try to pin down Pistol Pete, who was still shelling the western end of the Henderson Field runway, but they could not find him, and they soon had much bigger concerns. Coast Watcher Donald Kennedy, on New Georgia, warned of an incoming strike. Fighters were scrambled, but when nothing showed up on radar, the fighters came back down to refuel, only for the strike to show up on radar a little before noon. The bombardment apparently left the radar out of adjustment. As a result, its warning and the subsequent scramble was a little too late. If the Lunga airfield still had functional aircraft to take off from a functional runway, Admiral Kusaka hoped to fix that with another double strike. First up at 8:10 a.m. were 27 G-4Ms, 9 each from the Kisarazu, Misawa, and 753 air groups under Lieutenant Nabeta, though one Kisarazu bomber had to abort. Their escort was 18 Zeros, 9 from the 751 air group, 6 from the Tainan, and 3 from the 3rd, under Lieutenant Ito. Henderson Field scrambled 25 Wildcats, but it was too late for them to gain altitude for effective defense. The Beta's bombers roared in from the southwest. They may have looped around after passing New Georgia in order to throw off the timing of the launch of defensive fighters and drop their payloads on the already cratered main runway, where they counted 50 aircraft. What they saw were wrecks, damaged aircraft pushed to the side of the runway and used for cannibalizing spare parts in the boneyard. Almost all the effective American aircraft had been moved to Fighter 1, which the Japanese missed completely. There were no losses on either side. An hour later came Base Air Force's second strike. Lieutenant Doki Asamu led 12 Mitsubishi G-4Ms of the 751 air group with an escort of 15 Zeros, 9 from the 2nd Air Group and 6 from the 3rd, under Lieutenant Kurakane. This time they found very angry, vengeful Wildcats ready and waiting for them overhead, 9 Marine Fighting 224 Grummans under Major Gaylor. In the 4 minutes from 1:02 to 1:06 p.m., Gaylor's Marine pilots slashed through Doki's Bettys, quickly shooting down 2 and crippling a 3rd that later exploded in midair. One Wildcat, that of 2nd Lieutenant Kohler C. Brandon, was lost. The remaining Bettys split up to bomb both Henderson Field and Fighter 1, ineffectually, only to run into more Wildcats from the Saratoga. One was shot up so badly it had to crash-land at Buin. Another ditched at Rakata. All this time, Lieutenant Ito's Zeros were overhead, apparently checking out the scenery. They certainly were not protecting their bombers, but then again they didn't lose any Zeros either. Total losses for Base Air Force were 5 G-4Ms, with several more heavily damaged. According to the Japanese, the bombing raid was not very successful. While this was going on, Lieutenant Colonel Munn, one of General Vandegrift's staff officers, drove to the 67th Fighter Squadron's area, where he found 3 Army pilots and a mechanic. Munn briefed them. "I want you to pass the word along that the situation is desperate. We don't know whether we'll be able to hold the field or not. There's a Japanese task force of destroyers, cruisers, and troop transports headed this way. We have enough gas left for one mission against them. Load your airplanes with bombs and go out with the dive bombers and hit them. After the gas is gone, we'll have to let the ground troops take over. Then your officers and men will attach themselves to some infantry outfit. Good luck and goodbye." Lieutenant Colonel Munn's words were punctuated by exploding Japanese artillery shells nearby that twice forced the men to take cover. Already the Saratoga pilots, led by Swede Larsen, with no serviceable Avengers, had taken up arms to fight alongside the infantry. The bombardment had flipped the field from only 24 hours before. While all this was going on, the Seabees were still trying to repair Henderson Field, and ground crews were trying to cobble together some flyable aircraft from all the pieces of aircraft lying around. Working feverishly all day, throughout the Japanese air attacks, the fires, and Pistol Pete, the mechanics managed to slap together enough aircraft for a few airstrikes at the approaching reinforcement group. First was a group of 4 Dauntlesses, 7 Aerocobras, and 17 Wildcats, who arrived over the convoy at 3:45. They accomplished nothing except losing one Wildcat. By draining the gas from the 2 damaged B-17s, the Cactus Air Force sent up a second airstrike of the same 7 Aerocobras and 9 Saratoga Dauntlesses under Lieutenant Commander Kern, escorted by 8 Wildcats. They found the convoy at 6:05 p.m. east of Santa Isabel, with the transports in 2 columns. Heavy anti-aircraft fire in 6 zeros from the 6th Air Group out of Buin harassed the attackers into scoring only a near miss on the destroyer Samidare, and brought down the Aerocobra of First Lieutenant Edgar E. Barr, who was recovered. The 6 zeros were not, having ditched at Rakata. Even though 8 Dauntlesses of the Enterprise's Fighting 6 arrived just before dark, the night promised to be another difficult one for the Americans on Guadalcanal. That night, light cruisers Yura and Sendai, the seaplane carrier Nishin, again, and destroyers Asugumo, Akatsuki, and Ikazuchi landed 1,129 troops, 4 field guns, 4 rapid-fire guns, ammunitions, and provisions on Cape Esperance. With them was destroyer Shirayuki, who delivered a midget submarine base for Kamimbo. Guarding them was Admiral Mikawa, with his flagship heavy cruiser Chokai, heavy cruiser Kinugasa, and destroyers Amagiri and Mochizuki. When that was done, and while the destroyers stood guard, the cruisers spent a half hour lobbing 752 8-inch shells into the Lunga perimeter. It was unpleasant, but nothing like the night before. The Marines shrugged it off. What they could not shrug off was the view that greeted them the next morning. Brazen and bold, in full view of the Marines inside the Lunga perimeter, the 6 transports of the high-speed convoy were anchored and offloading troops, guns, and supplies. That was just insulting. Admiral Takama assumed that the bombardments by the battleships and cruisers and army artillery would keep the fires at the Lunga airfield grounded. But just in case, Takama had 6 Type 0 observation seaplanes from the R Area Air Force, 12 Zeros from Base Air Force, and 11 Zeros from the carrier Junyo to protect them. General Geiger's men were now scrounging parts to make aircraft flyable and scrounging aviation gasoline to fuel them. As they pieced individual aircraft together, they sent them up in individual attacks, accomplishing little except to put the men in danger. Saratoga fighter pilots Lieutenant Carl W. Pat Rooney and Lieutenant J.G. E.T. Smokey Stover made repeat strafing runs below masthead height on the transports until Stover ran into a Type 0 observation seaplane piloted by Petty Officer First Class Sakuma Kiichi of the Sanuki Maru, diving at him. Stover made a head-on run and opened fire, but missed. So did Sakuma. It turned into an aerial game of chicken. With Sakuma's apparent belief that it was a good idea to play such a game in a fabric-covered biplane with a heavily armored monoplane fighter doesn't speak well of Japanese training practices. Neither pilot turned. Stover's Wildcat drove through the peak float biplane, slashing off a wing and a wing strut. Sakuma spun into the ground. Stover managed to regain control of his fighter and land, where his right wing sagged with a foot-long gash, in which was caught a yard-square strip of black fabric containing part of a blood-red rising sun, edged with a gray circle. Stover kept it, as well he should. The ground crews also found 4 25-millimeter shell holes in Stover's Wildcat. In the interim, just as the Cactus Air Force was approaching its last drop of aviation gas, one of General Geiger's staff officers remembered that Colonel Woods, who had moved to Espiritu Santo, had managed to assemble hidden emergency stashes of gas. Geiger bellowed, "By God, find some!" And they did. Stashed away in swamps and thickets, were a total of 465 barrels, enough for 2 days of operations. Admiral Fitch had arranged for an airlift of R-4Ds and C-47s to run a dozen drums apiece to Henderson Field, braving the fire of Pistol Pete to land. Fitch had also arranged for the old Four Piper McFarland, now a seaplane tender, to bring in 40,000 gallons along with a dozen torpedoes. Yippies were running another 200 drums from Tulagi. General Geiger stopped the pinprick attacks and at 10:15 sent up five Marine Fighting 121 Wildcats under Major Davis, escorting a dozen Dauntlesses, two P-39 Aerocobras with 500-pound bombs, four P-400 Aerocobras with 100-pound bombs, and a PBY-5A Catalina flying boat with a Mark 13 torpedo slung under each wing. This was Geiger's personal Catalina, flown by Geiger's personal pilot, Major Jack R. Cram. Cram had talked a reluctant Geiger into allowing him to take the Catalina to mount a torpedo attack on the Japanese transports. Catalinas were ponderous aircraft used for scouting. No one ever had used a Catalina for a daylight torpedo attack, and Cram had never dropped a torpedo before. Other than that, Cram's plan was airtight. After saying goodbye to the other pilots, Major Cram went up in the PBY. Aerial opposition was provided by 6 Tainan and 3 3rd Air Group Zeros under Lieutenant J.G. Ono Takeyoshi, but the fighters focused on the Dauntlesses, dropping their bombs, shooting down 3, while Cram slipped in and dropped his torpedoes. Cram believed he got a hit, because of course he was going to get hit the first time he ever dropped a torpedo. The Dauntless crews believed they had gotten a hit. Certainly between them, the Sasago Maru was hit, starting a large fire. She had to be beached to prevent her sinking, a total loss, but her troops, tanks, and guns were landed successfully. The Aerocobras did not get a hit, but one of the newly arrived 339th Fighter Squadron, flown by Captain William Sharpstein, torched 1-0, apparently that of Seaman First Class Iwase Chisuke. As Major Cram came in for a landing, he was chased by 2 Zeros from the Tainan Air Group, flown by Petty Officer Second Class Sakurai Chuji and Seaman First Class Sugawara Yozo. They both perforated the PBY, but missed Lieutenant Roger A. Haberman's damaged Wildcat from Marine Fighting 121, which was trying to land. Wheels down and coming in to land, Haberman sent a burst of 50 caliber that detonated Sakurai's fighter. Sugawara made a lame strafing run and headed out. Grateful for the assistance, Cram landed safely, as did Haberman. At 11:45, transport Nankai Maru, having completed her offloading, headed out, escorted by destroyer Ariake. She got out just in time, because 5 minutes later, a flight of 9 B-17 Flying Fortresses under Major Ernest R. Monnier of the 11th Bombardment Group arrived. The B-17s had flown over Henderson Field, where men ran out from cover to the runway to cheer on the Flying Fortresses. Zeros moved in to engage the B-17s, but did not stop them from landing at least one bomb on the Azuma-san Maru, igniting a fatal fire that forced her to be beached to prevent her sinking. Nor did they stop the B-17s from all returning safely to Espiritu Santo. Her troops, tanks, and guns were landed successfully, but the tank fuel and ammunition she carried were lost. Base Air Force had yet to make its daily air attack, and Admiral Kusaka was certainly not going to miss a chance like this. Lieutenant Makino Shigeji of the 753 Air Group led 23 G-4Ms, 9 from the Misawa Air Group, 8 Kisarazu, and 6 753 in an attack on Lunga at 12:45 that resulted in some damage to planes and runways, according to the Marines. With the Cactus Air Force busy elsewhere, the Japanese had almost no aerial opposition. So their escort of 8 Zeros, 5 from the 751 Air Group and 3 from the 3rd, under Lieutenant J.G. Baba Masayoshi of the 751 Air Group, dropped back to join 9 Zeros from the 2nd Air Group under Lieutenant J.G. Futagami Tokitane to cover the unloading transports. But Japanese fighter protection was strangely ineffective this day, largely because of the lack of radios in the Zeros that would allow ground observers to vector them to intercept incoming attackers. That was how, at 1:15 p.m., yet another strike of SBD Dauntless dive bombers broke through to wreak more havoc. One well-placed bomb killed everyone on the bridge of the Kyushu Maru and started a major fire. Not knowing there was no one at the helm, the engineering crew kept the engines running at full speed and the Kyushumaru drove herself high onto the beach at Bunina Point, near Kokumbono. Her troops, tanks, and guns were landed successfully, but the tank fuel and ammunition she carried were lost when the ship burned herself out, becoming yet another total loss. Admiral Takama was not pleased with this situation. Far from being knocked out, the Americans were relentlessly attacking his transports and drawing blood. Their bombs had cost him 3 ships. Their strafing runs had wrought chaos, scattering landing parties and destroying barges and supplies. Takama pulled his ships out and had them mass north of Savo Island, where they could maneuver to avoid the air attacks. And they did so when another attack of 4 Dauntlesses of Bombing 6 arrived at 5:40. The attack failed, but Takama's hopes to resume the unloading after dark were dashed when the army representative waved him off with the message, "Moonbright, do not come." So Takama headed back to Shortlands. All 4,500 troops had been landed, but maybe only 2/3 of the supplies at a cost of 3 transports, 6 Zeros, and 1 Type 0 observation seaplane so spectacularly brought down. Air operations had cost the Americans 3 Wildcats, 3 Dauntlesses, and 1 Aerocobra. The Cactus Air Force still lived, but it was on the ropes. Help was on the way, though. The McFarland was en route with those 40,000 gallons of aviation fuel and 12 torpedoes, and even before the latest crisis, a supply convoy had been sent from Espiritu Santo. The convoy consisted of cargo ships Alchiba and Bellatrix, towing some gasoline barges with motor torpedo boat tender Jamestown and fleet tug Vireo, escorted by destroyers Meredith and Nicholas. The gasoline was urgently needed on Guadalcanal, but Pacific Fleet Intelligence and MAGIC was, ominously, unable to pinpoint the carriers of Kitobutai. For that reason, at 6:08 a.m., Admiral Gormley had everyone turn back. But the Vireo, with a top speed of 14 knots, was struggling to keep up, so she was detached with the Meredith as an escort, while the rest raced on ahead towards Espiritu Santo. At 10:50 a.m., a Type 0 reconnaissance seaplane from the Chitose found the Meredith and Vireo and attacked unsuccessfully. Then came a report that 2 Japanese ships were nearby. The report was inaccurate, but together these incidents spooked the Meredith skipper, Lieutenant Commander Harry Hubbard, enough to order the Vireo abandoned. After the entire crew had been taken aboard the Meredith, the destroyer positioned herself to scuttle the tug, which was when, at 12:25, the expected air attack arrived. It consisted of 8 Zeros, 21 Aichi Type 99 carrier bombers, and 9 Nakajima Type 97 carrier attack planes. They were all from the Zuikaku, who, with her sister ship Shokaku, was cruising east of the Stewart Islands in futile attempts to find the Hornet. The Meredith, having just recovered the Vireo's crew and preparing to scuttle her, must have been moving slowly, if at all, because it took only 10 minutes for the Sea Eagles to plaster the destroyer with several bomb hits and even get 3 torpedoes into her. Fearing their boat would be sunk, the crew of the Vireo had left for the safety of the Meredith, so naturally it was the Meredith that was sunk, while the Japanese completely ignored the Vireo and her tow. Apparently angry at their losses of 1 Val and 2 Kates to the destroyer's anti-aircraft fire, the Japanese proceeded to strafe the survivors in the water. A patrolling PBY found the Vireo and the tug abandoned and adrift the next day. It was 2 days later when the destroyers Grayson and Gwyn were able to fish 88 survivors out of the Coral Sea. 237 men were lost. The Vireo and her tow were not. But before she could become the Mary Celeste of the Pacific, on October 21st, the Grayson ran into her, literally. The resulting damage apparently light, the Grayson dropped off a salvage crew who successfully brought the Vireo and her tow back to Espiritu Santo. The sacrifice of the Meredith and Vireo did bring one critical benefit. The Zuikaku's airstrike was so focused on them, it missed the Alchiba, Bellatrix, Jamestown, and Nicholas, heading back to Espiritu Santo. A later airstrike of 5 Vals managed to get only a few near misses on the Bellatrix. But other help was also on the way. An angry Hornet task force under a vindictive Admiral Murray, eager to punish the punishers of Guadalcanal. Having finally finished her inopportune refueling, the carrier was heading back. As she did so, her radar picked up a Mavis flying boat commanded by Warrant Officer Yaoguchi Toshihito of the Toko Air Group, 30 miles away on its return leg to Shortland. Veteran Lieutenants J.G. George Formanek and Rickard Hughes were vectored out, and Formanek detonated the flying boat in midair. If Yelguchi even saw the Hornet, he never sent out a contact report. Barely taking notice, the carrier kept on course to cover Henderson Field and stop the nighttime bombardments. Admiral Garmley had also directed the Washington Task Force under Rear Admiral Willis Augustus Lee and Admiral Scott's Task Force to hook up and position themselves west of Guadalcanal to intercept these night